Hello, hello, and welcome to The Thin Blue Mind. Each week we will be looking at current policing issues and topics within the UK. Our regular panel consists of Steve Bradshaw, who is a TV and theatre actor, Richard Horton, author, and me, Dave Thomas, broadcaster. What we all have in common is over 80 years of combined police service. Now retired, we will be providing opinion and insights from the unique position of having been there and done it. Steve spent the majority of his service on firearms before being promoted to inspector, where he was a force incident manager. Richard was a career detective before going back into uniform as a response sergeant. Myself, I spent the majority of my service on the Rhodes Policing Unit before going into CID and Child Protection. You may not agree with everything we say, but we will make you think.
The Thin Blue Mind, with Bradshaw, Horton and Thomas.
Policing insights and opinions.
Well, hello, hello, and welcome to this week's episode of The Thin Blue Mind. This week's episode is rather topical, I suppose. It goes on the back of the recent news of the Metropolitan Police being put into special measures. One of the reasons that one could argue that's happened is because of the austerity cuts over the last decade, and it's caused police officers to look at the prospect of possibly striking. Certainly there was a big protest back in 2012, I think it was, around then, where pretty much everybody from England and Wales descended on London to march. So that's what we're looking at this week. Should the police have the right to strike? In law, we're not allowed to, and there's a reason behind that.
There's a historical basis to it, and you go back to 1913 and the formation of NUPO, the National Union of Police and Prison Officers. It had secret membership. It was largely based in the Metropolitan Police. It had 10,000 to 12,000 Metropolitan Police officers in it. If you were a member of it and found to be one, you'd be instantly dismissed and you'd lose your pension. However, in 1918, NUPO organised a police strike in London. And they wanted reinstatement of a sacked union members. They wanted a child care bonus. They wanted a war bonus, a widow's pension, which wasn't a thing. And they wanted 26 years to pension and a 30% pay rise. And the strike was solid, it held. And they ended up very, very quickly negotiating with the then Prime Minister, Lloyd George, directly. Pretty much everything they wanted was granted, which is interesting. It was followed by the Police Act in 1919, which outlawed NUPO and formed the Police Federation as we know it now. And that's how far the Police Federation goes back for us in history. The most recent thing we have is the Police Act 1996. It bans police from striking. It says we can't be members of unions. It set up the Police Remuneration Review Body and it made it a criminal offence to cause disaffection or incite strikes amongst the police. That's what we're currently running. And the Federation was created, as I've always said, it was made weak to be weak. And it is weak. We have no industrial rights as police officers. Interestingly, Police Scotland, potentially looking at a work to rule, which is as close as you can get to it. But that's your historical perspective, if you will. That's how we ended up where we were. And in 1919, there was another strike. It wasn't well supported. Everybody that struck in the Met got sacked. Everybody that struck in Liverpool got sacked. Liverpool was quite a scary experience. That was a complete law and order breakdown in Liverpool and 3 days of looting and rioting. And they ended up putting the army in, did the government, to restore order to the streets of Liverpool. But that's the last time we went on strike, effectively.
There's two issues, isn't there, that I see about the right to strike. It's the practical side of things. And then you mentioned the looting that occurred in Liverpool. And then there's the moral issue, isn't there, of should we be striking?
Well, the problem is, I think, you say they're the ethical and the moral reasons, and I think it grates against people for the very reason that they joined the job. It's not the Amazon coal-taking room, is it?
No.
People's lives, not wanting to over-dramatise it, people's lives are at risk, aren't they? And we serve victims, and that's what we as cops want to do. I personally think, yes, we should have that in the toolbox. Would it ever get used? It would get threatened, probably, and used in very exceptional circumstances. But like you say, I think the Americans call it blue flu, don't they, where we could either go sick, which has got some moral, ethical issues, or this work to rule. And we don't work to rule. It's been mentioned so many times over the last 10 years about working to rule. Don't stay on, don't do that extra overtime and stuff. But the problem is, it's not as if, would you please stay on? It's you're staying on. And Crown servants, we get told, we get a finger pointed at us, a bit like the army do, and say, this is what's happening. But my personal view is, yes, we should. And the issues that fall from that, as in, well, what we're going to do to police law and order, well, that's not for us to worry about. That's the black and white aspect of it. But when we look at it, police officers just won't work to rule.
And it's that Spartacus moment, isn't it? For it to work, everybody has to be doing it. But there are going to be people that will not strike in the police for whatever reason, and it won't be a moral one. And I don't think even a work to rule, I don't think it'd hold together.
I think we're one of those areas of business in the police where your positivity and willingness to toe the line, shall we say, is seen as a good thing and seen as being able to enhance your career. If you are in any way, hang on a minute, questioning sometimes in the police, or even saying, do you think we should do it like that? Or just generally being inquisitive about a decision, you're seen as a troublemaker in some ways. Imagine that to the scale of 1,000. If you suddenly said, right, I'm working to rule, you walk out, put your jacket on, the teen's under the cosh a little bit, you're seen as the bad guy or the bad girl, aren't you? Because you're the one who's working to rule. And that's why you say it needs to be uniform. And for me, there needs to be something allowing us, allowing the Fed to say, right, we are working to rule, which is set out and voted on.
Now, Richard, you mentioned the Federation in Scotland, which I believe are doing exactly that.
Well, yeah, and it's spawned one of those golden quotes. The SNP are cynically exploiting the fact that police officers cannot strike. That's Jamie Green, the Scottish Conservative Shadow Justice Minister.
You couldn't make that up.
You couldn't make that up, but there we have it. I think the proof of the pudding, we edge ever closer. 2013, there was a ballot in the Federation, should we take strike? Should we have that ability to become, to strike? There was a 42% turnout, which...
Poor.
Yeah, basically. 81% of those that voted that yes, we want the right to strike. But because the turnout was so poor, it wasn't felt that there was a mandate.
Do we assume the other 58% didn't want to?
The other 58% had it as 150 emails in their inbox and pressed delete.
And now here we are, what, 9-10 years on, and the Federation have now withdrawn from the Remuneration Review Body, which is meant to provide independent advice to government and was part of Police Act 96, has been part of the structure that we've had, police paying conditions for many, many years, and the Federation now think it's pointless to be a part of it.
Is that because, I may be wrong here, is that because the Remuneration Body was making recommendations that the government then didn't follow through on?
I think largely, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, what provides the guarantee of decent conditions and pay for police? In the system we've got, I'd say the only thing is government goodwill. And without that goodwill, there's nothing. And we can put in, we want 2%, 3%, 5%. We haven't been asking for the moon the last, you know, 5-6 years. We've been asking for between 3% and 5% generally.
So what are Scottish colleagues, what are they proposing to do then?
I'm not sure they've entirely shown the hand on that yet. I went looking to see what they were planning to do.
Maybe they're not sure themselves.
Well, sure. The stuff that they've got to do, legally comply with, they're going to have to carry on doing that. But I imagine they're talking about not working rest days. They're talking about not volunteering for football duty. And we get these emails that came round. Sure, I used to get loads of them. We need volunteers to do this duty or that duty.
It's filling the gaps, isn't it?
It was football related or it was protest or march related. And they'd look to get together volunteers. But of course, the thing was always said, if we can't get volunteers, then it's going to have to be picked men and women. But you could stop working your rest days, I guess. You could stop volunteering for things. I think that's what they're looking at.
But are we going to be able to do that, or are they going to be able to do that with unity? Cost of living crisis. I know when I was a young PC, I'd work your rest day. I'd work a time and off rest day because I wanted the money. You're going to have to get the unity, or else you're going to get division. And if me and you go on strike thinking, no, we're doing it for the wider reasons, and there's a couple of other people who need the money because they've got small families, it's going to cause division. And I think that might be the area where the Scottish Federation are a bit hesitant on, because they need to properly consult with their members.
I would look at a parallel experience, the criminal bar, who are currently doing intermittent strike action and refusing to take new instructions. And as I understand it from the news this morning, there'll be very shortly an emergency statutory instrument going through, giving them a 15% add-on to their legal aid fees. It's just temporary austerity. We'll get you back to rights. And they've finally had enough.
The long grass is the in political parlance,
absolutely,
isn't it?
Absolutely. You can kick the can down the road, but it remains a can, unfortunately. But they've shown the teeth. And I think they're likely to get more of what they want as a result of it.
It's another area of national infrastructure, shall we say, the law and order. If you bring that to a stop, you're going to get a response from the government. You're going to get it very quickly. I suggest that the issues we've had with the transport union, that'll get sorted very quickly, because the infrastructure cannot keep going with continuous strikes, which people blame the government for.
The problem I've always had with the idea of strike action or blue flu or any of the other things is when we, the police, didn't do what we were meant to do, people get hurt. Bad things happen.
Yeah, this is the issue. And this is why I don't think you can get the unity very quickly, as you would do with barristers or with the rail unions, because people might be late for work or people might miss a day's work. But with those, people die, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, we're no different to the military services. Well, we wouldn't expect, nor would they be allowed to go on strike. I am conflicted about this. Like you say, if we went on a full strike, which we can't anyway, but if we did, people would die. And I don't think, well, I couldn't live with myself if that was the case, if I was still serving. And I tell you now, eggs is eggs, but especially with social media. I still think we have a healthy respect from the public, despite everything that's in the news. That would soon very quickly change.
Well, think of it then as a minimum level of service. Somebody finds out exactly what that minimum level of service is, where we can respond to grade ones, we can do the very bare minimum in way of policing, a bit like the trains having a reduced timetable in a way, and then find out what that level is, and then the unions call to work at that level. I'm not saying strike as in everyone out and therefore there's no one in the nick. What I'm saying is find the bare minimum and have that as a thing you built on.
But again, it's finding that unity within the police service, which I don't think we'll get.
No, you won't get it because people will go, no, hang on a minute, I'm due at court.
Or I'm due a promotion.
Or I've been acting for 8 years and someone might bust me back down to sergeant if I don't do it.
It's harder and harder to keep the faith, though. When I joined, I'll swing the lamp here, but when I joined, the constable pay was decent, pay conditions were decent, the pension was 30 years, pay in and get a decent pension, and get out of policing before you got too old to do policing. That's all changed. The pay's not what it was. The conditions are certainly not what they were. And the pension has changed for those joining so that it's not the same reasonably attractive pension package. And in return for that, my life wasn't entirely my own. I had to get approval for where I was going to live. I had to work two orders. And it was clear that I'd have to put my own well-being, my personal safety, behind the interests of policing for the public.
Yeah, but you knew that about that.
I did know about that. Absolutely, I did.
So you knew that you were going to have these restrictions on your life because you were being a police officer.
And what was on the other side of that, which was the pay, the conditions, the camaraderie, the pension, just the general quality of working as a police officer was worth it.
I think in the, was it the 70s, certainly outside of our service, where the police were in a similar situation pay-wise and conditions to where we are now, and they had a massive uplift, didn't they, which is, and then that saw a big recruitment drive, which is why the officers of 30 plus, they all kind of retired a few years ago and caused this massive gap we're now trying to fill.
I think every so often you do get these massive intakes, but then you had... obviously what Tony Blair was trying to do. I think when you get a massive change and focus from law and order and the new government, especially a change of party government.
Possibly. Is this the Edmund Davis review we're talking about?
The review that recommended
a huge pay upgrade for police officers.
Are you talking about in the 70s now?
Yes. Looked and said police pay has become uncompetitive compared to other areas, similar areas. When you go back to the days of NUPO and the like, they were looking at Liverpool police pay was about equivalent to that of Liverpool city street sweepers. So that claim there, they're saying we want, you know, 50% on our wages, was not far off. The job asks a lot of you, and the job used to give a lot back, I think.
Well, I remember you had all sorts of additional payments, didn't you, on top of your basic salary, which is all gone now. I mean, I worked out a few years ago, me and the missus, who was still a police officer, what we lost and the fact that the wages weren't keeping up with inflation. In real terms, we were losing out between us about £700 a month, which is eye-watering.
That's a big chunk of money, isn't it?
Yeah.
It is for a service where, you know, you're risking your own well-being and your safety, but you come into it knowing that and you want to be recompense properly, and you feel that we shouldn't have to be fighting for all this because we can't strike. The pay review body, who's independent, needs to have a bit of teeth. Maybe police officers starting out, what is it, 21 grand, and they're doing a full-time degree, which we covered last week. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah, we're seeing the fruits of austerity now, aren't we? And the Met is not without its problems. And it, I don't think there's any surprise to the three of us that this was a long time coming for the Met. And there are other issues, but part of that is austerity. Lack of officers, lack of experience. And I tell you what, I think there's going to be other forces that are probably approaching that knife edge as well.
The six forces that are currently under special measures.
And I suspect there may be a lot more. They're not coping.
When one in seven of your forces are in special measures, something's gone awfully, awfully wrong with the state of policing in terms of resourcing, strategic directions. You'd suggest that perhaps police and crime commissioners haven't been the roaring success you would have hoped they'd been in every place. Whether they're going to take any responsibility for their forces going into special measures, we'll see. The Mayor of London seems to be taking no responsibility for the Met going into special measures.
No, it's kind of backfired on him a little bit, hasn't it?
A little bit, yeah.
How many times have we witnessed the DS going to the bosses and say, I do not have enough staff. I am bare.
It was starting in my time. Obviously, I left off the public protection unit to be promoted into the uniform branch and loved it that much. I never went back to detectives after that. Not so much we don't have the staff, although it was its cousin. My officers are carrying too many cases each. There is so much that they're carrying that we can't close what we've got before more stuff keeps coming in. And that didn't get any better after I'd left. I hear things just got a lot worse. People were carrying 20, 30 cases in serious sexual offences, in serious assaults, in robberies. You can't do that. An officer cannot carry that caseload, and yet it happened.
I think we've all agreed that we can't do an all-out strike. I seem to remember a few years ago, the Fire Brigade went on a big strike, didn't they? And I could be wrong. I'm not sure whether they were just going to buildings on fire or whether they were indeed letting them burn. I can't remember now, but...
We had the Green Goddess fire engines coming out of storage and the army running around with stirrup pumps and all sorts of stuff going on.
You couldn't... Yeah.
Well, then again, who was covering for them?
Well, certainly the police had an involvement.
Who was driving those Green Goddesses? Because I remember them all being lined up at Alt Car one day when we went for some firearms training.
One thing I remember about that strike, and it goes back to public opinion, doesn't it? And I don't know why they stopped striking, but ultimately they did. But I do remember the public were very much in favour of supporting the fire unions. And then it seemed to change on its head within a few days. I think if the police were to even work to rule, I think very quickly the attitude towards the police from the public would change.
I think the first time somebody was badly hurt or worse because we were delayed in attending, because we were short-handed, because we'd had members that were on strike or working to rule or walked away.
And that's a neglect of duty, isn't it, really?
Is it, though? Why not that extra discretionary effort? Is it a neglect of duty, or is it the fact that people have expected us to do that extra 20% all the time? And when we say, actually, no, get 20% more people, don't expect me to do 20% all the time. I could do it occasionally when there's an emergency, this extinguishing of duty that keeps getting used.
The public expects us to go to that stuff. The public expects us to put ourselves in between them and harm if we have the opportunity to do so. They don't expect us to go on strike and not be there.
No, but that can still occur. This is my point. If we find that minimum level of service and stick to it, so it doesn't mean that, well, those 30 investigations I've got, I'm not going to be able to do them. Basically, we're going to the people who pick up the phone and say, help, I need the police, and ring 999. We still go to that sort of stuff, but everything in the background just stops.
On response, we were there already. You can't pull response back to a minimum because it's been there for a while.
The only jobs you are going to is code ones because you've nobody else to...
Oh, code ones, code twos.
Yeah,
the minimum operating level, or MOL, as people call it, about the amount of cops we need to have on the street to be able to service it. We've been operating under that many, many times and for prolonged periods of time.
I always thought it was a fixed point, but apparently it's on quite a large, greasy scale that depends on how many staff you've got in on at the time.
My working definition of the minimum operating level, the MOL, is whatever you've got on, Sergeant.
Yes.
Oh, that's the MOL, strangely enough.
Yeah. And it's a difficult one, isn't it? Because we've said in the past, haven't we, that we don't explain ourselves sufficiently. But we're sort of straying into territory of, if we start explaining just how few there are, then it's confidential information, isn't it? It's information we don't want to get out because it'll assist an offender. And if he or she knew that there were no police about, I remember some forces were going to put trackers on their officers so the public could see where they were at all times. Brilliant intel tool for a burglar.
that's a third pip happening there. You can hear the temporary chief inspector's third pip materialising onto the shoulder as we go along. I've had a great idea.
I wish I'd thought of that one, to be honest.
But seriously, I mean, I think we're all of the opinion, aren't we, that we would never take action which would put somebody else's livelihood or safety at risk. And I know we're talking about work to rule, but putting my victim-focused head on, yes, all right, we're not, jobs aren't getting sorted, investigations aren't being progressed. And I can't help thinking about the woman that's reported a rape or a domestic violence and that's not getting sorted. And really, you know, looking at it both sides, to be fair, the defendants that have yet to be charged, I mean, not everybody is guilty of an offence. And for all that to just go in slow time, it's not good.
None of this conversation would be occurring. Police in Scotland wouldn't be considering a work to rule if we had an employer that we could negotiate with in good faith. If we had an employer who understood and accepted the independent remuneration board recommendations, who didn't take opportunities to take liberties with the pension system that we had. But all of that happened. And comes back to the thing I asked at the start, what provides any guarantee of decent pay and conditions for the police? It turns out it's not the Police Federation. It turns out it's not an independent remuneration and pay board. It's good faith by the employer. We haven't got it.
Or whether we're approaching an election cycle, and it's nice to say that law and order's high on that agenda of whichever party is batting for us.
We had that ersatz stuff with Theresa May when they were telling the public that crime's under control, we don't need as many police officers, everything's rosy in the garden. The crime statistics seem to get changed every year, so no one year is entirely comparable with the previous ones, and that's smoke and mirrors.
Were you crying wolf, Richard?
I cried wolf loudly. Thing is, there was a wolf. That was the problem, but she said, you know, don't cry wolf, there was a wolf, and there she was. All of this, because of the unique position, or the near unique position we have within society, of not having industrial rights, of being very much at the mercy of our employer. We need a good faith employer, and we haven't got one.
I read a quote, and I might, paraphrasing it, I might have got it wrong, but the wolf has convinced the sheep that the sheepdog is the enemy.
No, yeah, entirely possible. I don't put my hopes in the Federation, I never have. There's a lot of very, very good things the Police Federation do and can do on behalf of us.
At a local level, I think they're brilliant, but at a national level, not so much.
Because they don't have that right. And whenever you're negotiating with anything, you need a stick in your back pocket. And if you don't have it, and they know you don't have it, yeah, so what? What are you going to do?
Judging by the conversation we're having, I mean, ourselves are going around a little bit in a circle. I mean, what we do know is that cops have just had a bellyful and absolutely sick and tired of the way they've been treated and the pay that they're getting. What else is there to do? What can we do?
What's happened in the past, the last time things got critical, we talked about the report in the 70s, all of a sudden you're not getting recruitment, you're not getting retention, and you realise that you must do something to make policing once again an occupation that people want to go into, and one of the best ways of doing that is add in some pay.
I think we stop talking to the government, who just smile and wave at us. We start talking to the public about it, because it's the public who will make the government do something about it. Or potential new government. And I think it's highlighting our plight and actually how bad it is to the public. And whenever police get slating because I never got a cop that came round because my car got crashed into, well, yes, you won't, because that is the policy and the direction that the government has forced us down. And we need the public to be informed so they can make true representation to the MPs and government.
Okay, well, I've erected three masts. I'm going to ask you to nail your colours to them. So, Richard, right to strike, yes or no?
No.
Steve?
Yes, but a work to rule, but not a full-on strike everyone out and the army covering. I mean, we need to do something, and it's a work to rule.
Yeah, and I suppose that myself is definitely no to strike, and I'm kind of 50-50 with the work to rule. Now, there's only three of us here, three different opinions, and that essentially is the problem.
Yeah, that's the problem, and that's why you're not going to get that consistent approach from cops, not because they're not interested in it, it's because they care about the job that they're doing.
Could we make the Fed stronger by having a national vote and having a high 70s, low 80s% turnout in favour of industrial action? Well, it would give them a platform to stand on, but I'm not sure it would make them a lot stronger, unfortunately.
There was one of those e-petitions online at the government, the Parliament website, which got 16,960 signatures. For all the police officers in England and Wales and the family and the public that support them, we managed 16,960, which I think is ridiculously low. And obviously, the government have a right to reply, don't they? And the response to that, because they got more than 10,000 signatures, they have to respond. The response was without any ambiguity. The Home Secretary has been clear that police officers cannot strike. That is not going to change. As a civil emergency service, it is vital that the service is able to discharge its duty to protect the public and keep the peace at all times, particularly those of serious national and local disorder. Basically, it then goes on to say, if this petition gets over 100,000, we'll revisit it. And it got 16,000.
Unfortunately, whether we like it or not, it's a not on my doorstep type of attitude these days, isn't it? And unless something is affecting somebody directly, then it's not their problem and not for them to worry about. 16,000 is terrible. I mean, 16,000 is disgraceful, considering we've got, I don't know how many cops we have at the moment in the UK, 130 or something they used to have. I would have expected 130 at least, because surely every cop has an opinion on it, surely.
Yeah, and every cop's family would vote for it as well. But again, this is why we're not going to agree.
Well, there you go. Depressing, isn't it? But we are where we are with it.
The pendulum will swing, I do believe. I say when it gets to the point when officers are leaving in droves again and not joining the job, there's going to have to be a thought by whichever government is in as to how they're going to fund more police and make it a more attractive thing to do. But we're not, that pendulum's not even started to swing back yet, I don't think.
The Thin Blue Mind with Bradshaw, Horton and Thomas.
Policing insights and opinions.
This is Radio Nightjack and the Thin Blue Mind podcast.
This is Radio Nightjack, broadcasting from a comfortable location in rural East Lancashire. This episode's called Can't Get There From Here. It's a song by R.E.M. from 1985 from the album Fables of the Reconstruction. Fables of the Reconstruction. What I'm looking at is one of the most basic things that police officers and the other emergency services need. We need to be able to communicate with each other, and we need to be able to communicate with our control room. At the moment, what we have is a system called Airwave. Airwave was implemented through terrestrial trunk radio. It's known as Tetra, and it's basically a walkie-talkie for police officers. It's also the system that allows us to speak with our control room. It's the same radio that we have in our vehicles. It's been around for quite a long time, and frankly, it's creaky. And we were looking at a replacement for it, and the Home Office got involved. The Home Office got involved and decided that Airwave was yesterday's technology, which it is, and they wanted to use mobile phone technology, for a simple phrase. They wanted to have an emergency services network based on 4G and 5G capabilities, so that police officers and other emergency services, all the people that currently use the Tetra trunk radio system, they would be able to have a new system based on existing mobile phone technology and some new mobile phone technology that hadn't quite been worked out yet, that could carry not only voice in the same way that the walkie-talkies did, but video and data, and be properly encrypted. And it's interesting to look at how a project for something absolutely crucial to emergency services capabilities has been managed by the Home Office. It's fair to say that although the Home Office have brought in specialists and consultants to try and run the provision of this new emergency services network, the people actually responsible for the project, the people funding it, the people demanding it, the people looking to implement it, that was the Home Office. So we have this legacy system called Airwave, and the idea was that Airwave would be out of the way possibly by 2017, that we'd have the old radio-based system drop away, and instead we'd have something newer and shinier that would be the emergency services network. Didn't quite go according to plan. It's fair to say that the costs of not delivering this emergency services network to date have gone up from 6 billion to something closer to 9 billion, a massive overrun. Part of the terrible cost of that is that the Tetra system, the old radio system, has had to be allowed to creak on, and the company Motorola that runs the Tetra system has just signed up in 2020 a 6-year extension for the life of Airwaves, taking it through to 2026 at a cost of 1.2 billion. Just let that sink in. 1.2 billion pounds sunk into allowing this creaking old system to continue creaking on for us until 2026 because its replacement isn't ready. As of 2019, there were various problems identified in the ESN, the Emergency Services Network System. EE, the mobile phone company, they're going to provide quite a lot of the mobile phone mast coverage that this new system is going to run on. And the Home Office is also going to provide some sites in areas that are sort of harder to reach so that this system has national coverage. Well, back in 2019, EE didn't provide all the network coverage quite yet that they needed to. The Home Office had yet to commission its share of the masts that were meant to be happening. The Home Office hadn't put out a contract for air-to-ground capabilities and hardware, which was fairly key to it. There's perhaps 150 aircraft that need to be on that system, and they didn't have any kit. Technical solutions for the aircraft had been tried, but nothing was really available. Nobody had written a deployment plan, just how are we going to get all these new pieces, all these new walkie-talkies, these new handsets into the hands of all the people that need to use them. And they're talking about 130,000 handsets, 50,000 vehicle sets, 500 control rooms, police and ambulance and fire and rescue that need to be brought together with this new kit and have it installed, and about 300,000 individual users. That's quite a big deployment plan. Wasn't ready. There was no coverage on the London Underground, which was a major issue for users who were going to have to use it on the London Underground. And Samsung, who were the chosen providers for the handsets, didn't have enough handsets available, even if we'd wanted to deploy and everything else was all right at the time. This was a project that was getting somewhat out of hand. In 2019, the Public Accounts Committee produced a report and talked about the Home Office in this particular project having an unhealthy good news culture, ignoring the warning signs that the emergency services network wasn't deliverable. Some of those warning signs you think might have been spotted. You've got EE on one side with their kit and Motorola on the other side with their technology. And the early stage in the project, Motorola's technology was not compatible with EE's technology. I think nobody had checked particularly. Some of the capabilities that they wanted for this ESN didn't exist. There was a hope that the technologies would come into focus and suddenly be available. It hadn't happened. And back in 2019, the end users, the emergency services, were not confident that ESN would work for them. That's definitely going to be a problem. So it was delayed till December 2022, then delayed to December 2024, and now it's delayed till 2026. It's not a happy tale. That overrun currently will be around about £33,000. For every person that's going to be using it, for a system that has been delayed since 2017 and nearly a decade on, will possibly come in to fruition in 2026. Is it down to EE? Is it down to Motorola? Is it down to the Home Office not being able to organise critical national infrastructure project properly, not making it an absolute priority that this thing be done well and on time? I'll leave you to make your own mind up on that, but I have to say the evidence currently is that there's been failure after failure to produce a workable emergency services network, that ability to talk to each other and to the control room, but it's not there. But the Home Office can't sort it out. And it begins to feel, with the good news culture in the Home Office, they're telling fables of the reconstruction. And as far as ESN goes, every time the new implementation date comes up, you can't get there from here. Well, this is Radio Night Jack saying thank you, and stay safe wherever you are. I'll be back in a couple of weeks with another tale. Until then, you take care.
The Thin Blue Mind with Bradshaw, Horton and Thomas.
Policing insights and opinions.
Well, that's it for this week. Thank you for joining us. This podcast is in partnership with Policing TV, the leading policing media channel. So until the next time and the next podcast, take care.